If you're an adult now, you've watched the map of the world change just a bit over time, where once there were two Germanys, now there's one, where once there was Czechoslovakia, there's now Slovakia and the Czech Republic. We'll explore a less official form of the world map in this hour, one that takes into account places that think of themselves as countries and the rest of the world often disagrees. They range from the very serious, like Tibet, to the more whimsical, like the Free Territory of Christiana in Copenhagen. Nick Middleton collects 50 of them in an atlas of countries that don't exist. Nick Middleton teaches at Oxford University. He's a geographer, a writer, and a presenter of television documentaries. Going to Extremes is a series he wrote and presented on England's Channel 4 about people living in extreme environments. The book that accompanied the series is one of seven travel books that Nick has written. Pleasure to have you on board, Nick Middleton. Thanks for joining us.
Very nice to be with you, Jeffrey. I have to say your weather forecast sounded distinctly British, cold and wet.
I've been thinking about them in those terms lately, indeed. The front of the book, An Atlas of Countries That Don't Exist, is lettered like something from Middle Earth, but this is not fiction, is it?
It isn't. It isn't. It might sound like fiction in the case of some of the names that may not be familiar with some of your listeners, but they're very real places. The reason they don't exist, in inverted commas, is because they're unrecognized. The conventional countries of the world that we see on the normal political map of the world don't recognize the existence of these 50 non-countries, but that's not to say that they're not there.
Well, and that's a really interesting concept, the sense that the world, in a way, votes on our existence. And the way we sort people geographically, I mean, I get the idea that the concept of a country is fairly modern.
It is quite modern. And actually, when you try and define it, is not nearly as straightforward as one might think. I'm sure most people intuitively know what a country is. But once you start to pin it down, it's a notoriously slippery concept. Every time you think you've got it, you find an exception or an anomaly. And trying to find a universally accepted definition of a country, a nation or a state, you know, there we are, three different words that are used more or less interchangeably. Trying to find a universal definition of any of those terms is impossible. It doesn't exist.
I remember during the Soviet Union days trying to refer to people as Soviets because, well, they're not all Russians, see. But I remember getting some bruised feelings from people who lived in parts of the Soviet Union. Didn't want to be called Soviets.
There you are. But they probably wanted to be called Russians even less.
if they're from Abkhazia or something, sure.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And as you said at the top of the intro there, during my lifetime, the map of the world has changed very significantly. And one of the most significant ways it changed politically was with the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And suddenly we had 15 new countries. And this map that, I suppose, again, intuitively, we probably think or don't even think, we just assume that it doesn't change very much, actually changes a great deal. And in the last 50 years or so, we've seen a lot more new countries than lost countries, but you pointed out that East and West Germany united to become one. North and South Yemen, likewise, united to become one. But there are many more others that have arisen in the last 50 years. Soviet Union, we've mentioned, East Timor, Montenegro, South Sudan have all popped up as legitimate nation states in the last decade or so. So it is a changing map, and this book that I've put together collects together 50 wannabe countries, places that would like to make the grade, as it were.
So let's mention one of these before we get too much farther down the road, a flip to the middle of the book kind of thing. What's the story on Sahrawi?
Sahrawi. Sahrawi Republic is in the Western Sahara. It's it used to be a Spanish colony. There weren't many of those in Africa. But the Spaniards moved out, and almost immediately the Moroccans moved in, even though notionally it was supposed to get independence. And for the last 50-odd years, the United Nations has been trying to sort the place out. But possession is nine-tenths of the law, and what should be a republic known as the Western Sahara or Sahrawi has in fact been occupied by Morocco, and most of the people who should be living there, the ethnic Sahrawis, have been living in refugee camps in Algeria. And it's become quite Kafkaesque, because for decades they've been trying to have a referendum to vote on whether Sahrawi should be fully independent or not. And the hitch has been trying to draw up the list of who's allowed to vote, because the Sahrawis don't actually live there, so the Moroccans say, well, they can't vote because they're not here. And there are lots of Moroccan settlers who have been encouraged to settle in this area who do live there, and yet, of course, they're not going to vote for a Sahrawi independence. So, as I say, it's become a sort of horribly Kafkaesque situation which, to date, no one can resolve.
Well, and there's even a wall there, I understand. This is not a boundary wall for the country, but something else. What's going on?
Yeah, well, politically, you see this place often is depicted with a dotted line to separate it from Morocco, but de facto it is Morocco. Then there's a line on the map like other political boundaries, but actually the Moroccans have built a physical wall, as it's an earth bund, a big, long wall going on for hundreds of miles, literally to keep the Sahrawis out and protect their settlers. And why are the Moroccans so interested in settling Sahrawi? Because it's full of phosphates under the desert surface, and there are very rich fishing grounds offshore. And that's a common factor in many of these would-be places that are ruled by other countries. In many cases, they've got highly desirable minerals or geostrategic position that makes them very attractive, and the big bully type countries are going to hang on to them to the bitter end.
Well, another case of resource plunder in Africa. That's what we're talking about with Sahrawi. One of several examples, one of 50 examples in the book, An Atlas of Countries That Don't Exist, a compendium of 50 unrecognized and largely unnoticed states put together by the British geographer Nick Middleton. He's our guest. You can join the conversation on The Exchange. We're back in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Nick Middleton, who is taking us on a bit of a world tour of places that think of themselves as country. The only trouble is the rest of the world does not. He's given us an atlas of countries that don't exist, a compendium of 50 unrecognized and largely unnoticed states. Think Tibet, think Taiwan, which Taiwan in particular acts like an independent place, but China certainly doesn't think of it that way, and neither do the world's ruling bodies. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's bring one actually fairly close to you in the UK, the world's oldest continuous ruling body is in this place. What is it?
It's on a small island between Wales and the island of Ireland. We're talking about the Isle of Man. And it's had its own indigenous parliament, which has run continuously since the 8th century, believe it or not, set up by the Vikings. And the Isle of Man is still running as a sort of quasi-independent nation-state. It's not fully independent in that their passports are issued by the British government, but they look suspiciously like British passports, and yet they're not. It's not a part of the United Kingdom, nor is it part of the European Union, and yet they use British currency, albeit that the notes look rather different. They've got a much younger picture of the Queen on their pound notes than we have. They set many of their own laws. They raise their own taxes. So is it a country or isn't it? Well, it's a difficult question. And the Isle of Man actually is another interesting example in that, relatively speaking, I think they're pretty happy with their lot of being quasi-independent. Many of the other non-countries that I've pulled together in this book, I think there's an element of despondency and gloom, and they would like to be more independent. But the Isle of Man, that doesn't really apply. They've been ploughing their own furrow, as I say, since the 8th century. And relatively speaking, I think they're pretty happy with their lot.
Do Does anybody speak the Manx language anymore, Nick?
Yeah, people do on the Isle of Man. Not commonly. I'm not sure whether it's still taught in schools or not. You've got me there. I'm not entirely sure. But there are people who do still speak Manx. And there are Manx cats as well, as you may, may know. Traditionally, they don't have any tails.
Yeah, born without them. Yeah, I've always wondered about those. The idea of drawing borders brings up the story of James McCarthy in Siam in 1880. What did he do?
Yeah, well, he helped the king of Siam at the time to draw up the boundaries of Siam. Although the king took a bit of persuading that he needed to do such a thing, it was quite interesting. Prior to the 19th century, and this was the case in much of Europe a few hundred years previously, no one sort of bothered with borders as we know them today. They didn't really need them. They didn't have detailed maps. People who lived in towns and villages knew the nearest ruler or the nearest power base. And there wasn't a particular need for a hard and fast border. They might have a border on along a track or a road. They might say, oh, well, this is where the Kingdom of Siam sort of more or less stops and somewhere else begins. But off-road, as it were, in jungles or uninhabited territory, no one would bother with a border. Until the European powers, and in this case the British in Burma, started moving in and taking charge and cutting down trees and setting up mines and so on. And at that point, the King of Siam decided actually perhaps he should delineate his borders carefully and decide exactly where the kingdom began and ended. And hence, he hired another Brit, in this case this guy McCarthy, to draw up the boundaries. And some of them were known to local people, and although not with the sort of definition that we like to think of boundaries today, you know, you put up a fence or a border post and a border guard, and it's very clear where one country stops and another starts today in most parts of the world. But in those days, you know, a villager would have an idea about, oh, it's out there somewhere, maybe at that tree. Oh, I'm sure it's one of those trees, but which one specifically didn't particularly interest them. It wasn't important until, as I say, the European powers started gobbling up resources, and then ownership of particular patches of land became important, as it is as we know today.
Now, some of these disputed countries are places that wish they were countries. I mean, are they also the result of British map making? Much has been said about Afghanistan being a rather unnatural agglomeration of different tribal areas. And Baluchistan, I think, is probably also a problem caused by British map makers.
Yeah, you're quite right. And in many cases, that is the case with these places. They're unfortunate carvings out by people who, in some cases, never actually knew the territory itself. They were sitting in London or Paris or some other European capital with a big map and drawing lines, often with a ruler, that took no notice whatsoever of local people and local conditions. And Baluchistan is an interesting example, which was actually chopped up by the British when they decamped from what was then India, chopped it up into India and Pakistan, and gave other bits of what was a traditional tribal land, Baluchistan, to Afghanistan and some to Iran. And there we are. They sort of waved their magic wand, drew the lines on the map, and hey, presto, Baluchistan had ceased to exist. But, of course, the Baluchis had other ideas, and they've been fighting off and on for their independence ever since, the last 50 years or so. And in many cases, these non-countries are the result of colonial interference in local power relations.
Well, and obviously some of these are places of great controversy. I notice there's no Palestine in here, though.
No, there you are. I deliberately decided to exclude both Palestine and Israel, for the reason that they're both members of the United Nations, and that was a criterion that I decided to adopt that all of the places that I would include would lack a UN seat. And in both the case of Palestine and indeed as Israel, there's quite a large number of countries which don't recognise their existence, but in both cases there are more countries that do recognise the existence. I mean, and that's why I say there's no universally recognised definition of a country. Much of it is in the eye of the beholder, interestingly enough.
I noticed that you bring up Transnistria and Abkhazia, two parts of the former USSR, and they actually belong to a commonwealth of unrecognized states. And you point out there's more than one organization like that.
Yeah, there we are. I mean, we think of the United Nations as being the sort of gold standard for sovereign states, and indeed it is. It's the club for sovereign states. And that's why I say recognition is so important. For these non-states, many of them have set up their equivalents of the United Nations. So there's the unrepresented United Nations, the UUN, which has more than two dozen members. There's also UNPO, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization. So because recognition by someone else is a key part of the makeup of being a country, many of these non-countries got together to create their own shadowy alternative organizations. And as I say, many of them are fairly large. Those two I've just mentioned, UUN and UNPO, both have dozens of members. There are smaller equivalents. You mentioned Abkhazia. They're in a four-point Community for Democracy and Rights of Nations, so-called the Commonwealth of Unrecognized States, also known as. They're four splinters of the former Soviet Union who have got together and recognize each other. And there will, that is the case. Recognition is not essential, but for many it's part of the game of being a country. If you're recognized by other countries, then you're almost there. That's not to say that there aren't quite a number of examples in this book of non-countries which are only recognized by one country. So those splinters of the former Soviet Union that I mentioned, Abkhazia, Transnistria, they are recognized by Russia, but only Russia as a member of the United Nations. Likewise, the non-country of Northern Cyprus is recognized by Turkey, but no one else. So it once you get down into the detail, it's fiendishly complicated out there.
It truly is. Nick Middleton is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, geographer, writer, presenter of television documentaries, teacher at Oxford University. His latest book is called An Atlas of Countries That Don't Exist, a compendium of 50 unrecognized and largely unnoticed states. You can join the discussion and propose additions to the list. Perhaps there'll be a volume two. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. British caller says, yes, the Manx language is still taught in school. Paul in Grants Pass didn't stay in the line, but he wanted to know to what extent ethnicity plays a role in people determining that they are a country, or perhaps, let me flip it the other way, and people deciding that they're not somebody else.
Yeah, there you are. Ethnicity, cultural identity are both critical in many of these cases. I mentioned Northern Cyprus. The reason that island was effectively, from a political standpoint, chopped in two in the mid-1970s, was because the island is dominated on the one hand by Turkish Cypriots and on the other hand by Greek Cypriots. So the Turkish Cypriot community now live in northern Cyprus and the Greek Cypriot community live in the south. And this is the case with many other examples. There's an interesting example in modern-day Iran. In the southwest, there's a province that's traditionally been inhabited by Arabs and therefore culturally very different from the rest of Iran, which is inhabited by Farsi-speaking Persians. And that area had a fair degree of autonomy prior to the 19th century.
That's the place called Awaz, isn't it?
Awaz, yeah, exactly. Awaz or Arabistan, it used to be known as when it had quite a degree of independence, or in modern Iran, it's known as Khuzestan. So it's an Arabic-speaking corner of Iran where the culture and ethnicity is quite different. And another example, actually, of a place where the hopes of becoming more independent, I think, are slim, simply because Ahvaz or Khuzestan has the mainstay of Iran's very rich oil wealth. So the likelihood of them being let go by the Iranian government is pretty slim.
Is the oil wealth is obviously being taken out, but what conditions do the people live in Ahvaz?
Today, not bad. They've had a troubled history of rule from Tehran, central Iranian government, and for a period the Arabic language wasn't taught in schools. They weren't allowed to wear their traditional dress. That's not the case today, but every now and again the resistance or attempts to become more autonomous bubble up to the surface. And it's put down in no uncertain terms. So there's still a fair degree of grit in their relationship with central authority in Iran.
Let's take a call. We have Kale in California on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Nick Middleton, the author of An Atlas of Countries That Don't Exist.
Hi, I would like to hear a little bit about Christiani Freetown out in Denmark and what you might think about the future of that city-state. I'm not sure what you'd even call it. And I'll take my response off a little.
Okay, yeah, we've referenced that a couple times in some of the teases coming up for this segment, but Christiani Freetown appears to be entirely within Copenhagen. How'd that get started?
Yeah, there you are. It's an old hippie commune. I'm sure most of your listeners will remember the hippies, or if they don't remember them, they'll have read about them. So early 1970s, this group of hippies illegally occupied an area of Danish Ministry of Defence land in the heart of Copenhagen, the capital of Denmark, and they've been there more or less ever since. Set up their own commune, they have their own schools, they run things in an ultra-democratic way where everyone has to agree on how they govern themselves, and they govern themselves as a collective. They have rather different ideas on certain things than are prevalent in the rest of Denmark. So you can buy soft drugs openly in Christiania, whereas it's illegal in the rest of Denmark. Used to be hard drugs too, but that's no longer the case. But they're allowed to exist by the Danish government because it's the sort of ultimate liberal paradox, as far as I can see it. The Danish government are fairly liberal, and therefore they don't want to elbow this lot out of the way, and yet they're squatting on government land. And in more recent times, the last few years, since 2012, the government in Denmark has effectively tested the community's values by offering to sell them the land that they've been squatting on for decades. And that's in conflict with one of their basic raison d'etre, which is their commune is set up as an alternative to the capitalist system. So ownership is fundamentally at odds with their very reason for being. So here they are, they've got till 2018, I think it is, to decide whether to buy the land that they are squatting on, which in one sense would secure their future, but at the price of the very principles on which the place was set up.
They'd have to be different from who they were to be able to make the claim on their own land.
Well, exactly so. Exactly. It's the ultimate paradox.
It's a little off topic, but here's an email from Bill in Arcata asking about maps, a little more generally about the distortion in maps, and what do you think about the Boston school system dropping the Mercator projection that has been used so often over the years?
Yeah, there you are. The Mercator projection is a classic projection for world maps and smaller chunks of the world. The problem with Mercator comes when you do see large portions of the Earth's land surface, because it distorts the relative size of large portions of the Earth's surface. So if you look at a Mercator projected map of the world, Often Greenland looks more or less the same size, if not larger, than Africa, whereas in fact it's very much smaller. So it tends to distort the high latitudes towards the poles, which is where the rich and powerful people live, like myself and yourself and our countries, and that's why historically it's been so successful, fundamentally. And it's still a jolly useful projection to look at smaller portions of the Earth's surface, because the shapes are true, but for the world map, I think it's rather dated and really quite misleading.
So
I'm in favor of getting rid of it in schools.
What do you get instead of Mercator projection? Do you have the orange peel slicing of the Earth's surface?
Yeah, there are multiple options which try to balance out this difficulty of trying to portray what is a three-dimensional object, essentially a sphere, on a flat piece of paper. And lots of them do it with varying degrees of quirkiness. There's a Winkle triple projection, which does a very good job of balancing this difficulty of trying to get a three-dimensional sheet shape onto a flat piece of paper. But there are lots. Winkle triple, I think, has been adopted by National Geographic as a decent midway point between Mercator and the Peters projection,
okay,
which is a Danish one again.
All right.
But
back on the Jefferson Exchange
well
in 1 minute with Nick Middleton. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the British geographer, writer, presenter of television documentaries, and Oxford University teacher, Nick Middleton. He's written a book about the things that don't appear on maps of the world. It's called An Atlas of Countries That Don't Exist, a compendium of 50 unrecognized and largely unnoticed states. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about these would-be and wannabe and have-been and in some cases never will-be countries. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Nick, there's a fair amount of tiptoeing, obviously, on some of these. I mean, how carefully does the world not recognize Taiwan as an independent country?
It's the ultimate elephant in the room, isn't it?
Truly.
So many countries pretend that they don't, that they do and they don't recognize it. Your own president raised the issue, rightly so, quite recently, because it's a very interesting example, because both the Constitution of Taiwan and the Constitution of mainland China claim that it's one China. And, of course, both of them include the other. But Taiwan's very interesting in that it used to be a member of the United Nations until they kicked it out. So it had there's one Chinese seat in the UN. It was Taiwanese. It was sat upon by Taiwan until 1971, when the rest of the countries decided, well, actually, yeah, we've only got one seat for China, but it's not yours anymore. We're going to give it to the mainland Chinese. At which point, most, not all, but most other members of the UN decided that they weren't going to recognize Taiwan. And yet, you know, Britain, for example, we don't have official diplomatic relations with Taiwan. We don't have an ambassador there. We don't have an embassy there. But we've got a sort of trade bureau, which acts suspiciously like an embassy, and a senior representative who does most of the same sorts of jobs as an ambassador. So lots and lots and lots of countries, with the exception of a few very small island states who get quite a lot of aid from Taiwan, they do recognize Taiwan as a country, but most other UN members don't, and yet still have dealings with them as if they are a country. So, as I say, it's the ultimate political elephant in the room.
Well, Tibet certainly comes into that category, too. And it's not just China that gets tied up with Taiwan and Tibet. There's also Japan and its situation with Ryukyu. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Ryukyu is an ancient monarchy. It's a chain of islands, an archipelago, which is between the main Japanese islands and the Asian mainland. And it was invaded by the Japanese in the 19th century. And most recently, they've been trying to get it back, or at least a few academics have been pointing out to the Japanese government that actually there was this chain of islands that had a monarchy. It was invaded by Japan. And why? How? On what basis? In many cases, these non-countries have been sort of quietly absorbed into the main fabric of a larger state, and this is certainly the case with Ryukyu. In other cases, Tuva is another one, representatives have actually asked to join a bigger neighbour. In that case, Tuva was asked to join the Soviet Union, as was, and is now still part of Russia. And it's an indication of how little most other countries take much notice of what's going on in faraway places, that some of these countries are absorbed into bigger countries like Ryukyu and Tuva, and no one notices, often for years. I mean, the Soviet Union was a closed book, but an ambassador in a faraway country, a British ambassador, told me the story once that people in the Foreign Office in London hadn't realized for several years that Tuva had become part of the Soviet Union until someone was reading the Great Soviet Encyclopedia and saw the entry and in which it was stated that Tuva had asked to join the Soviet Union, and I put that in inverted commas, and had been happily absorbed. And it's still there to this day.
Wow. So I'm surprised to find out that it's not just the colonial powers that did some carving up of places, that even the places that they had kept as colonies made their own moves, and particularly talk about India and Sikkim.
Yeah, there you are. Sikkim was effectively invaded by India and absorbed into India, despite being independent for a short time after the end of British colonial rule. Yeah, you know, big countries, when they decide they want to gobble up a small country, there's not an awful lot you can do to stop it. And if the big country is a real big country like India or China, there's not much the other powers will do to stop them behaving exactly how they want. And in Sikkim's case, it's strategically in a very important position between India and China. And if India decides they want it and gobble it up, as they did, then there's not an awful lot the Sikkimese could do about it.
And let us not gloss over claims in North America. You have two countries that don't exist in the middle of America. Lakota is up here first.
Lakota is a very interesting example, which to most people has been forgotten about. I'm sure it's not forgotten by Lakota Sioux, who live there. They signed a treaty with the U.S. government in the 1860s, and the treaty said that the territory that they were living on, which included the Black Hills, which was sacred territory to the Lakota Sioux, should be given in perpetuity to the Lakota Sioux. Sadly, a few years later, General Custer led an expedition into the Black Hills, and gold was found, and suddenly all bets were off. But not the case if you're a Lakota Sioux, and it's sacred territory. So for 100-plus years, they fought the U.S. on the battlefield and subsequently in the law courts to get their territory back. To cut a long story short, the U.S. courts found in their favor. They offered them or awarded them compensation backdated to the 1860s, and now it's a huge sum of money, more than half a billion U.S. dollars. But the Lakota Sioux won't take it. And they're not rich people, they're very poor people, but there is a principle involved. And they say, well, you know, actually, we don't want the money, we'll just have our land back, please. Fat lot of good it's done them, to the extent whereby in 2007, a delegation from the Lakota Sioux went to Washington and formally withdrew from this treaty, which the U.S. government hasn't honored since the 1870s. And so there we are, the Lakota Sioux have restated their sovereignty, but it hasn't done them an awful lot of good. Sadly, even though they had this piece of paper, and in many cases some sort of formal declaration is a gold standard for independence, in the Lakota Sioux's case, it hasn't done them much good.
Well, you could make a huge companion volume of legal papers that go along with some of these cases.
You're telling me, yeah.
So while we're on the subject of the lost countries in North America, Ned in Phoenix, Oregon, wants to know if you have any thoughts on the California Republic or Pacifica or any other variations you've heard about that.
Yeah, I don't know an awful lot about it. There are quite a lot of examples in North America, some more serious than others. In a sense, it's an indication of the flexibility of the Constitution of the United States of America that people can stand up and declare independence. And at the one end of the ridiculous end of the spectrum, some people declare independence for their front rooms or their backyards, and I haven't included those sorts of examples. I've only including serious ones. But there are many, many to choose from.
So let's talk about other places where there are real desires for independence going on and some choices that you made in the book. For example, you got the country of Spain. You included Catalonia, but not the Basque province. What were you thinking?
Yeah, they were. I was keenly aware that I would upset people, some people with some of my choices. And, you know, the rule of thumb that you're never going to please all the people all the time is unquestionably applicable here. Well, in some cases, and the one that you've just highlighted is a case in point, I had a choice. You know, the obvious candidates in Spain were Catalonia and the Basque Country. In this case, I decided to show one but not the other. I could have chosen it the other way, and to some extent, the choice is fairly arbitrary. But one illustrates an important point, and in Spain's case, that point is that many of their regions have a degree of autonomy, and both Catalonia and the Basque Country do. Catalonia runs their own police force, their own schools. As you probably know, they have their own language, their own flag, and every now and again they have a referendum where they ask the people whether they'd like even more autonomy and independence. Madrid, central government in Spain, scoffs at the results of these referenda, but nonetheless it indicates that there's a fairly widespread desire for greater independence too. Whether they'll get it or not, only time will tell.
And then isn't the other interesting case here is a place that acts very independently and doesn't appear to be declaring independence, and that is Somaliland, which seems to function a whole lot better than its parent state, Somalia.
Yeah, well, they have actually declared independence in 1991. It's just that the rest of the world takes no notice of them. It's another very interesting example, because once you go into this, what is it that makes a country, one of the fundamental, slightly intangible aspects of it is that states and central governments exercise power, set down rules and set down laws. And Somaliland's an interesting case because after falling out with the rest of Somalia, there was a civil war, and then they declared independence and said, right, we're off on our own. And have actually done pretty well for themselves. So for more than 25 years, they've run their own economy with their own currency. They have a democratically elected parliament and president. And, of course, the rest of the Somalis, the rest of Somalia, as I'm sure many of your listeners are keenly aware, has been chaotic. There's been no central government whatsoever. There's been civil war, famine, you name it. It's been a non-state. And yet Somaliland, which has been relatively peaceful and well-ordered for the last 25-plus years, not recognized by anyone. No one will recognize Somaliland. It's another example, like Taiwan. It's an elephant in the room type situation, because the rest of Africa and the rest of the world prefers to think of Somalia as one place, whereas de facto, certainly for the last 25 years, it hasn't been one at all.
A case where there might be independence, and fairly soon. What's the current status of negotiations in Greenland?
Greenland is an interesting case, because of all these 50 non-countries, if I had to choose one which has the best chance of independence in my lifetime, it would be Greenland. It's been a colony of Denmark for nearly 300 odd years, and yet in recent decades, the Danes have been giving them more and more autonomy. So in 1979, Greenland got home rule. In 2009, they got self-rule, so little degrees of extra control over their own affairs. And many people look at the year 2021 as being an auspicious time when it might be that Greenland gets independence. And why 2021? Because it's the 300th anniversary of the beginning of Danish colonial rule, and that would be a very auspicious year for Greenland to get its independence. So watch that date.
Will do. Okay, so just about a minute left here, Nick, and I want to ask about one of the parodies that you include in here, Hutt River, which is actually in Australia, right?
Yeah, it's Australia's longest existing micronation. It's an old wheat farm that fell out with the central government when they got they were told that they had to produce less wheat. The farmer and his family did their sums, realized they couldn't make ends meet with these new quotas, tried through the law courts to get the decision put off, failed, and eventually said, okay, right, we're Hutt River Province, we're separate from Australia. And that was in 1970, and they're still going strong. They sell stamps, their currency. You can go to Hutt River and get a stamp with your passport, send a postcard home from the post office, and yet it's not recognized at all by the rest of Australia, needless to say.
It's a really interesting list of books, and obviously it could have been a whole lot longer than the 50 that ended up in here. It's called An Atlas of Countries That Don't Exist, and there's some special details in here which we couldn't really get into on the radio, the die-cut pages that show the maps through them and that sort of thing. Nick Middleton teaches at Oxford, geographer, writer, presenter of television documentaries, and the author and our guest. Nick, glad to have you today on The Exchange.
Very good to talk to you, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me on.
All right, take care. And that'll do it for today's Exchange. Our producer is John Baxter of JPR News. Our student assistant, Waleed Almoteri, is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us next time and have a great day. Thursday on the Jefferson Exchange, an hour one underground history returns with our resident archaeologists and a guest who's written a book about the unique nature of archaeology in the West. In hour two, the best intentions running aground in the Mississippi Delta. That's where Michael Kopperman went to teach poor kids, to his delight and his frustration. That's coming up on Thursday's Exchange. This morning's program airs again from 8 to 10 this evening on the News and Information Service of listener-supported Jefferson Public Radio. Thank you.